You are listening to a Core Confidence Life production. www.coreconfidencelife.com.
Don't take no for an answer. Welcome to the Core Confidence Life. I am your host, Dennis, broadcasting to you from New York City. And you are listening to the Core Confidence Life podcast. And we are coming at you with more men's personal development. And so today is don't take no for an answer. Being able to persevere through rejection to make it to the top of your field. And we've got a person coming on the program to talk about his journey to the top of his field. And his field is so exclusive, we actually are not using his real name. So stay tuned for the climb up the ladder. And the answer to no is no. All right. As always, I forgot to give you a disclaimer. I might curse, you know? I might say a couple of words, and them words might set your ears on fire. Actually, I doubt that because we're all grown men, right? Welcome to the Core Confidence Life. I'm your host, Dennis R. Sumlin. If you're just joining this program this time, your first time, welcome. Share with the rest of your friends. I am a coach and educator, and my goal is to help you as a man tap into your personal power and develop that core self-confidence to enable you to attract the relationships, success, and life satisfaction you desire. That's right. Absolutely. On the stage, in the office, and at home. So we're talking about self-confidence on the program. And coming up in just a couple seconds here is someone who is going to tell us a story about not taking no for an answer. Folks, have you ever been trying to achieve something and you get told no? Now, the big singers that we hear about on the radio all the time and the big actors and all these people have heard no 1,000 times before they made it, right? No. Tell me people who are told no. One person that comes to mind right away without me pre-preparing this is Patti LaBelle. I think she was told no a couple times before she made it. A lot of people have been told no. If you try to do anything big, you're told no. If you try to walk outside of the box of society's prescriptions for you, you're told no, right? If you try to rebel against the stigma because it's smothering you and your identity, you're told no. But we can't listen to, we can't say yes to no, all right? We cannot say yes to no. And one of the things that it takes to say no to no is a core belief in ourselves and our abilities and a core belief in the dreams that we're going for. You know, in society, you know, I have this thing they call a disability, right? I can't see. And so you might imagine that because due to the stigma and misconceptions about people with disabilities, I'm told no, and I'm before anyone gets to know me, I'm put into a box. But the important thing is to understand that those boxes aren't actually limiting you. They're limiting the people who try to put them on you. So coming up, we're going to talk to somebody who has decided that he's going to go for his gold regardless on how many times he's heard no. Go for your gold, no matter how many times you hear no. Richard is an assistant to a high-ranking politician in the United Kingdom. His background is in journalism, and today, here on the Core Confidence Life podcast, he is here to share with us his rise into journalism in an unconventional way. And he's going to talk about how the power of self-confidence allowed him to bypass all the no's and create all of the yeses. Due to his status in the UK, we cannot share his true identity. Because Richard works for a high-profile politician in the UK, we cannot disclose the last name. But we're going to talk about Richard, his rise, his story, his struggles, and even more. What's going on, Richard?
Yeah, I'm really good, Dennis. How are you? Sorry, I would have to shoot you, obviously. You know, I couldn't tell you my secrets and my secret name, I'm afraid.
That's right. You're a secret secret agent, man.
Oh, if only. If only.
If only. So, Richard, tell us, what are you doing right now? We know that you're a high-profile dude, so we can't disclose, like, your actual identity. So, what are you doing?
Well, it's not so much high profile. I'm kind of behind the scenes. I used to be a journalist and a podcaster, and now I do like media communication. So I'm working in the political world. You know something about that, Dennis, don't you? On politics.
Yeah, I've worked for a couple of campaigns here locally in New York and so forth. So
exactly,
I definitely understand.
Yeah, it's pretty high pressured. You know, you've got a lot of stuff where you got to try and work out how to get message across, how to communicate with people, how you can kind of find out what people's problems are and translate that into a way that you can get it across to the media and all that kind of thing. So I do a lot of that sort of stuff, and I help out the main politician I work for and other people to try and communicate stuff in the best way and interact with the public and get stuff done, basically, because politics is one of those things where you don't just press a button and things happen. There's a lot of ins and outs of it, as you know.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, you are a very, very busy bloke, I tell you. And that's a good thing. But you're not necessarily here to talk about politics. You're here to talk about your rise, your struggle coming from the bottom.
Wow. I mean, it's interesting, Dennis, because I've been listening to your show for a few episodes now, and it's like, I love the way that you're kind of saying to people, you've got to follow your dreams. You've got to actually listen to yourself, this confidence thing that you're getting across. Because I was told before I got into journalism, and I was working in, you tell me I can say this, a shitty office job. I hated it. Absolutely hated this thing. And I managed to make a connection. A friend of mine was a news editor, and I lost that job because I basically told them to stuff their sales figures. I couldn't give up. And I lost that job, went to work for another firm for 2 weeks. They hated me. I hated them. I was unemployed again. A friend of mine was a news editor for a local paper. And I said, look, can I come into your office and apply for jobs somewhere warm, just so I can chat to someone while I'm doing it? And I never thought I could be a journalist. And I did that. I was sitting there in this office and the phone rang and I picked it up and I spoke to this person. And after chatting to them for a few minutes, I found a story that the next week appeared on the front page of the paper. So there I was, just there. And just due to circumstances, I realized that maybe actually I could do this thing. Maybe I could be a journalist, because the paper were delighted that I'd found out this stuff. So then I started thinking, okay, well, do I really need to get this boring office job that everyone always thinks you've got to be stuck in an office all the time? And I started asking friends and family. And one of the comments I got, and it was a family member, and I know they meant well, but they said, you don't have what it takes to be a journalist. And that was kind of, oh, okay, maybe I don't. I listened to that, but I still kind of carried on dabbling. So I started applying for proper jobs. And it just wasn't in my gut. It just wasn't there to actually go after these rubbish jobs. So I thought, right, well, I've still got time while I'm doing this. Why don't I just apply for a journalism course? And I applied for it. And I started to get to know, I just met this guy at the local radio station through this news editor contact. I met him, I got to know him, started chatting to him and sort of said, oh, can I help you out? Applied for this course and I went along to the selection day, and I was told by the guys at the radio station that this was a really tough selection day. You basically start at the beginning of the day, and if you're there at the end of the day, you've got a place in the course, and it's a knockout. And I was told they were absolutely brutal with you. And I went in there and I did this selection day. And at the end of the day, they offered me a place on the course. And I was like, wow, couldn't believe it. All of a sudden, here was the person that told me you don't have what it takes to be a journalist was clearly wrong. And I went into the radio station the next day during my lunch break from the next little office job I got. And went in there and I said, you know, I've been offered this place in this course. And they said, well, if you give up the course, we will take you on now. And remember, I had no journalism training at all, no journalism training. And we will train you on the job. And it was like, wow, I can't believe it. Someone is just going to offer me money. And it was really low money. But someone's going to offer me money to literally go behind a microphone and read a pre-written script. I mean, someone's going to pay me to do that. And so I rang up the course and they said, I'll just take the job. Just take the job. You don't need to do the course. I was like, great. So I started going into the radio station. I took the job. And I used to just sit there behind this microphone as you're listening to the jingle the DJs are playing before you're about to start reading the news. And I just used to burst out laughing. You know, just spontaneous. It just came out of me. And I could not believe that just weeks before, someone was saying, you don't have what it takes to be a journalist. And here I was with someone giving me money to do this. It wasn't a job. It was just fun. Yeah. And I think the core lesson from that is that at times, whatever people say, just keep still following that dream. Even if you're just chipping away, even if you don't believe it's ever going to work, just keep going on and just keep chipping away at it, because you just never know who you're going to meet, who you're going to bump into, where you're suddenly going to go, actually, this works. This makes sense. And you find yourself doing it. I did that. And I started sort of doing more and more news reading. And then I spent 2 years at that company. Then I started working for other radio stations. And one of the great things about radio is that your CV, you don't have to write a CV. People hear you on the radio and they go, okay. Let's invite you in. So I started getting invited into other radio stations. And then I applied to do some freelance work at this organization called ITN, who are the second biggest news organization in the UK. And I went in there just to do some freelance shifts. And after, I think it was 2 months after I'd started doing a few of them there, I turned up one day and the editor called in sick. And there was no one there. And I'm convinced it's because I was the oldest person in the room at the time. They said, you're at the editor's desk. It's like, what the heck? I had all these experienced journalists around me who made life pretty damn hard. But by the end of the week, the editor still hadn't come back and I was still in that chair. And a week later, they offered me a job as a full-time duty editor at ITN. And I had no journalism training. All these people who'd been to university and done 3-4 years of journalism training. I had no legal training, nothing like this. And there I was, an editor of this organization. And it's just, as I say, you just got to keep chipping away, keep chipping away. If you really want to try something, you just got to go and do it.
You know, it's a good story. Very good story. So I want to go back to that moment that that person told you, because a lot of people have gone through this. Journalism people, certainly people who are pursuing music careers have been told off to their face, this is garbage. This is, what are you playing this for me for? So a lot of people in these kinds of fields have been told off to their face. So how were you feeling when someone told you, well, you just don't qualify to be, you'll never be a journalist. Get out of here. You're rubbish. Like, take us through the feelings that you had when that was told to you.
I think the problem is when people say stuff like that and you haven't seen evidence in your life yet that you can achieve something, you take it as fact. And that's the mistake you make. You just kind of, you're constantly looking, even though you say to yourself, you know, actually, I might be okay at this. The moment someone says you're not, you tend to let that overrule it. And that's exactly how I did it. I just thought, okay, well, I clearly don't. But something inside me just kept me chipping away. Just kept me looking for opportunity. There was another example. I loved motorsport as a kid. And you don't have a lot of rally driving in the United States, but this is where you take like a 300 brake horsepower car and you drive it down a forest road. These are all organized events. And you drive it down the road as fast as you can over a set course. And I wanted to do this. I desperately wanted to do this. And I didn't have any money to do it. And I saved and I saved and I saved. And I tried to meet as many people as I could. And I tried to find ways of wangling my way into getting to sit in the navigator seat. So in rally driving, you have a driver and you have a co-driver. And eventually I was trying to fix something on my car outside my house. I got chatting to this guy who was doing some painting next door on the house next door. We found that we got a common interest in rallying. We started talking about it. We got to know each other really well. And he said, I've always thought of doing it as well. And he said, why don't we buy a car? So I didn't have the money. He was like, I'll buy it. So we went along. We started looking for cars. Here we were looking at these powerful cars. Couldn't believe my luck here. And a few weeks later, we were entering our first event. So I was reading the maps. He was driving the car. And it happened because, again, it was just about going, you know, I just want to chip away. And I've got to keep looking for these opportunities. And luckily, I mean, you know, from when I first got interested when I was about 16, I think I did my first rally as a co-driver when I was about 20. So it took 4 years, but I got there and I didn't have the money really to do it. You just never know.
Right. So how did you move past that point when you were told, get out of here, take your journalism and your underwear, dirty socks, and get out of here? So what was there any kind of strategy, psychological strategy or whatnot that moved you through that period of feeling like, oh,
I'd love to say there was actually a plan in there. It wasn't. It was that there was just something inside. There was just I think one thing here is that you've got to be honest and truthful with yourself. And it's like, if there's something that you just feel, you've just got to keep going. You've just got to let yourself be guided a bit by that. You know, it's so often in life we do listen to these people that say don't do it, or you know, we listen to the people around us who say you can only achieve that. I remember a kid at university who, he was a brilliant computer programmer, and his dad was a factory worker, and this kid thought, well, I can never be a computer programmer. I mean, the guy could have been making a fortune as a computer programmer. He said, I've got to work in a factory because that's all that's open to me. You just gotta keep following that dream. I mean, in later life, if I've learned a lot more about these processes and how you can kind of overcome negative stuff. But at the time, it really was just, I guess I probably did stuff then just instinctively that perhaps now I do in a more structured way when I sort of think about things now. So there was no particular strategy at the time, I got to be honest.
All right. So I'm taking that to be that you had a core inner drive to do this.
Yeah.
That this is something that's part of you intrinsically. It's part of your DNA to become a journalist, to be out there. So there's just that thing in your system.
Yeah, but I don't think I necessarily wanted to be a journalist. There's a lot of people that go into journalism that do it because they want to be famous. And I was always interested in people. I was always curious about hearing people's stories, and I was fascinated by the way they work. And that was what really interested me. I'm trying to think of a sort of great example of this, but I was just always nosy. I wanted to know what was going on. I wanted to know what made people tick. I was just naturally curious. And so it's like one of the first things I did when I first started working at a radio station while I was reading the news was some guy sent a press release about the fact they were doing this environmental protest. And I thought, well, what is it that drives people to do this kind of thing and to try and block airports and things like this? So it wasn't even to progress my career. I was just fascinated by it. And so I got in touch with them and I said, look, can I come along and spend some time with you? And I did, and I gained their trust, and they got to know me, and I made this report. And it wasn't some grand plan to become the greatest journalist on earth. It was just because I felt that I was really interested, and I thought people would want to know what makes people tick. So it fascinated me, and I think it was that more drove me. It was nosiness, to be honest.
That's actually even a better answer than specifically journalism, because it shows that you have an innate drive. You were curious about people. You wanted to hear their stories and experiences, and you found ways to get there and gain people's trust, and then turn this curiosity of yours into money, into a career. So yeah, that's actually even better than wanting to be a journalist, taking something innate inside of you. I'm just curious about people. I don't know how this is going to apply, but I'm curious about people. I want to see if I can get myself into hearing these stories, and you did it.
But I think there's another element in that, which you make a really good point, Dennis, is that if you want to be a journalist, what does that mean? Because a journalist is the effect of doing the stuff that makes you a journalist. So it's like people kind of go, I want to be famous. And it's like, well, okay, well, famous is the result of those actions that you have to do to become famous. So are you interested in doing those actions? Because if all you want is fame, you ain't getting that.
Yeah. You know, this is a good, I have a, you know, I have a similar story. You know, growing up, I've wanted to speak. Like I wanted to speak. I wanted to voice things. I wanted to teach. I wanted to, I didn't exactly know the road I was going to do it because I had all, I want to be on the radio, but then I want to make an album, but then I want to teach, but then I want to be a therapist. So I didn't know what to do with all of these talents, but I know I wanted to do something with it. And I put myself in situations in which I got to speak a lot.
Yeah.
And I got to teach a lot.
Yeah.
And I got to, you know, whatever. And it just kind of over time comes together. And then when you go out there and pursue that passion of yours, even if you don't have a title for it yet, you will run into luck.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. If you feel that drive, you did exactly the same thing I did. Because if you're feeling that, you start to look for opportunities.
Absolutely. I got tapes here from when I was 11 years old, creating little skits, using my own voice, you know, to make all these different voices and stuff. I have probably every podcast I've ever hosted, almost every podcast I've ever guested on. Yep. I've got me when I used to call talk shows when I was a kid. I mean, I've got all these things and I didn't know where all these things would end up. I just was pursuing what I wanted to do. And then eventually, you know, over time, you run into the right people. Because another thing, which is, I'm going to go to this next, which is you got hired without any of this kind of formal experience. People will help you when they see you're trying to help yourself.
Yeah. And when you're passionate.
Yes.
I mean, I remember people coming into the newsroom. So when I was an editor, and you get people coming in, and I do have this problem with people that just want to be famous because it really annoys me. It's like, well, particularly as a journalist, because, and there's too many of them now who are there who are just because they want to be famous. I always believed that journalism was about trying to serve people, was about finding information. And okay, it's very difficult. The world has changed a lot, but I still believe that as a journalist, your aim should be to objective. You can hate someone, you can despise what they're doing, but you should still try and explain that story because it's not for you to be judgmental. It's for the audience to be judgmental. Yeah. Your job is to give them the facts so that the audience can go, I think that person's an idiot. It's not your job to tell them that that person is an idiot. And there's too much of that now. So I think if you're genuinely, sorry, I kind of went off there, but when people came in and they wanted to be famous, I really struggled with that. When someone came in and they had a curiosity and they were interested in finding about the world and explaining stuff, I had all the time in the world to help them as an editor. And I did. And so, well, people helped me in the same way.
Absolutely. And you're right. You know, journalism is about reporting the story.
Yeah.
And not kind of inserting your bias in there.
Should be.
but so let me ask you, I don't know a whole lot about journalism. So let's say that you do. I mean, we all have biases.
Yeah.
So let's say that you are a journalist and you are assigned to covering, oh, I don't know, Jeremy Corbyn. You know? What if you can't stand that guy? What if you think he's full of rubbish and you can't believe they put you on this bloody assignment?
Well, okay.
What do you do? Can you say, no, I'm not covering him because I'm going to be too biased? Like, out of something that you...
No. Okay, so here's an example. I did a documentary about sex tourism. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know. I always felt that, so to me, this is my bias coming out. I always felt that the sex tourism industry was either done in a sort of titillating way, as in, you know, it's like, oh, it's kind of funny, or it was done in a shock horror way. And I wanted to know the truth. So I made this documentary where I just let different sides of people talk. And I deliberately didn't conclude the documentary. I actually said in the piece, I said, you've got to decide for yourself how you feel about this. So instead of, so when I approached people, there was one particular guy who was, he was from the States, and he came across to London, and he used to, I mean, I can't remember what the word he used was, but he, you know, used to visit the girls in different countries. And I could have gone in there and I said, why did you do this? Why? You're a bad person. You're causing these girls to take drugs. You're, you know, I could have laid into the guy. But instead what I did was I said, look, why? And I asked him in an honest way. I didn't just go, why, you bastard. I just said, why do you feel? Why do you? How do you feel about this bit? How do you feel about that bit? And I let him talk. And sure, if he started to sound like he was going off on a weird one where he was trying to defend himself, then I asked around it. But I never attacked him. I just let him have the chance to speak in the same way I let the vice cops have the chance to speak, in the same way I let the prostitutes, the madams, and all this have the chance to speak, so that they could give their side and the listeners could decide how they felt about it. And you can go into it with a degree of bias, but you, if you're an honest journalist, if you, it really makes me annoyed this, because if you're a journalist, your job is to deliver the facts to the audience. It is not your job to say who's wrong. I said it already, but that really does get me about journalism today. So I would interview anyone. I mean, you know, if they told me to go across and interview, trying to think, you know, the head of ISIS. Okay. I, you know, hopefully you get out with your life, but I would do it because I would want to know why. Genuinely, why? Why do you feel that you could murder people like this? Why? And I want you to explain it to me so that the listeners can go, well, either you're an idiot or, well, hopefully no one would ever agree with it, but I want them to make that decision.
Yeah, that's really important. So there's so many different things, because I know I have your bio here. I know you've talked about, or you've interviewed sex traffickers. You've also interviewed and did stories on the disability rights movement.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. I don't know if this could be a different show, but I would like to know more about that. You know, a lot of people may or may not know who's listening to me, but I guess if you're listening to me at any length of time, you might have figured out that I'm blind. So that would be very interesting to hear more about, but I don't want to get too far off track on this show. We can do that on another show. That'd be very interesting.
Sure.
So when you got to the top of this particular office, being editor and stuff with no experience, how did that make you feel going, wow, I got here with no whatever. I don't have a degree in this. I don't have this, but I'm actually here at the top. How did that make you feel?
There was two feelings. One was, this is absolutely incredible. And I still had that feeling that I can't believe they're paying me, and by that point, pretty good salary, for doing this when I should still be working in an office. I mean, to be honest, this is interesting actually, Dan. In the situation I'm in now, my job will come to an end next year because of a political situation. And my gut tells me I have to get a regular office job. And I am, you know, quite a few decades older than I was then. And still in my gut, I've got that feeling you've got to get a proper office job, that you can't achieve anything else, even though I've got the evidence in front of me. So I was sat there going, this is incredible. I still can't believe that someone's paying me to do this stuff. So there was that, but there was also and I'm sure everyone's heard this word, the imposter syndrome. You felt like, how could I possibly be here with all these people who've done 3-4 years of training? How can I be the editor in the room at the moment? It's like I'm conning people. And I think that's one of the struggles that we all, whatever we're doing in life, whether, you know, you're just starting out, whether you've been working in something for a long time, is if you still have these doubts inside yourself as to, you think that everyone else around you is this amazing expert who knows everything. They don't, but you still in your gut kind of feel like you're conning people. And yet there I was, you know, I wouldn't have been given that job if I hadn't been able to do it. So it was a mixture of delight, but also fear that I was going to be found out.
You know, that's very interesting. It made me think of something that happened to me with the imposter syndrome, or otherwise thinking of otherwise discrediting yourself. And this is a long time ago, probably like a decade ago. I was working at a media company. You know, my job was to go out there and recruit artists and get them into the system and put together this album and do some commercials. And, you know, I actually liked that job. That was a really fun job.
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's great. I'm glad I had that job. But I used to always go, wow, I'm not all that talented. I'm not, that was a lie. I'm just doubting myself. Yep. You know, I'm not all that talented. I'm not all this, like, you know, why? And the people, my supervisor and his supervisor, they got me in that little office and they let me have it. You know, they said, look, why do you keep saying that about yourself? If you weren't shit, then you're calling us stupid for hiring you.
Yeah.
So by you putting yourself down, you're insulting us.
Yeah.
Because we hired you. You didn't beg for the day. We called you in here. We already heard of you before we hired you. Like, we know what we're doing here. Like, so if you're putting yourself down, if you feel like you're an imposter, if you feel like you really have no talent, you're not only are you saying, you know, screw yourself, you're saying screw us too.
Yeah, absolutely.
They let me have it. They cornered me. They had this big giant frozen pork chop over my head saying, don't move. And they let me have it.
I think one of the problems, though, is that you kind of only learn this as you go through life. And yet, if you only realize this early on, that everyone has a talent. Everyone does. You know, even if you're 10 years old, you know how to do something better than someone else. Everyone has a talent or a skill or something. And the moment you accept the fact you are actually good at something, you can start to take advantage of this world. And it's, you know, sometimes you need that, don't you? You need that boss to shout at you.
What's sick about the imposter syndrome and other ways of discounting your talents is that, I mean, that story I told from 10 years ago, I had been doing things up to that point before then. By that point, I had already had my first podcast, my political podcast. I had already been running things. I had already been teaching. I had already been doing these kinds of things. But yet, I still felt that I wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what the previous 30 years showed me. Mm. I just wasn't good enough. And then so somebody else, and people who hired me, had to let me have it. The lies and the deception that your own doubts give you, in spite of all the evidence in front of you, your brain lies to you.
Well, that's the silly thing. There's a phrase which I quite like from the NLP world. And it goes something like, if something is humanly possible, consider it within your reach. Yeah? Mm. It just makes sense, because if other people are doing it, now, yeah, of course, some people have got advantages. Some people were, you know, born with money. Some people weren't. But if it's possible to do physically, you can achieve it. It might take you a bit longer, but there's nothing stopping you apart from you.
Absolutely.
Now, convincing ourselves to do that and to actually listen to ourselves is, you know, what we're saying is the whole struggle of this. But there is absolutely nothing stopping it. I was convinced I could never be a journalist, and yet I was.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So the evidence is there that, I mean, hell, if I can do it with no training, then other people can as well. Just be nosy and you can become you could do exactly the same thing as me. There's nothing special about me. I was just a nosy bugger that liked to know what was going on.
You know, I think part of this is what we do. We tend to get starstruck, like, wow, they're a journalist. Wow, they're a politician. Wow. And we kind of elevate these people in this kind of one-dimensional starstruck mentality, not realizing that that person is just like me.
Yeah, absolutely.
That person puts their pants on the same way as I do. That person just probably had sex last night like I did. That person just finished coming out the bathroom taking a leak like I did.
Yeah.
Like, they're just like me. They have good points and bad points. They're human. So because they have a job that we like or that we admire, doesn't elevate them above us.
But that also, it's this mental attitude. I remember getting into the lift with this really famous presenter in the UK. And it was just me and him when I got to ITN. And I got in there, and to me, it was like getting into a lift with a deity, you know, with just something supernatural. And he was the most charming guy, and he turned to me and he just said, oh, you know, what do you do? And pretty much all I could say was wibble. I mean, I just couldn't find the words. I was so starstruck. And I got out the lift afterwards, and I was just kicking myself, because it was like, there was a chance for me to just have a genuine conversation with a guy who's just an ordinary guy. The fact that he was incredibly famous was irrelevant. He turned to me and he said, you know, hi, how are you? You know, what do you do here? He gave me the opportunity to chat to him just like anyone else down there, the bar or the pub or your mates. And that was exactly, he didn't approach me in some high and mighty way. And I was just, it was purely in myself that I put out that mental barrier. And I thought, what do I say? And it's like, well, just talk like you would normally. You know, so, and that's purely psychological. What stopped me in that moment? Nothing physical at all. Nothing at all. Just me. Because of that image I created in my head of this, you know, godly type figure. And it's like, he was just a guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And when we elevate other people in that one dimensional starstruck way, we're putting ourselves down.
Yeah.
You know,
but you don't need to put yourself down or up. You know, as you just said, people are going to the toilet just like us.
That's right.
They are human beings. They're ordinary people. And that's just right. Because they're on TV, just because they're in, you know, they're a rapper, just because they're an Instagram star doesn't mean they're any different to you.
Absolutely. No.
They had to get there some way. It's not magic. They didn't just suddenly become this famous person. Yeah. Somehow they got there. And if there's a way they got there, which there is, there's no reason you couldn't do it too.
That's just a good point. Like, we tend to think that people are born that way. Oh, that's a singer. No. Oh, they politics. They weren't born that way.
Nope.
They were born babies pissing on their mama's cleavage, you know, from the very start. Like, they weren't born
absolutely
a journalist. They weren't born a superstar. They were born a baby. They had to cut the umbilical cord like everybody else. They had to develop into that.
Yeah.
They fell down. We don't know how many times that famous singer was cursed out.
No.
And told that they wasn't ever going to make it, and then they end up making it. We don't know that. We have no idea, you know, how bad their mama used to beat them because they stole candy from the store when they were 10. We don't know any of that. We just look at them as one-dimensional gods, and we need to get away from that.
I think that's, I mean, I'm not a great reader. I don't particularly like reading books, but if you go on the internet, you can often find out pretty quickly the stories behind these people. And if you just dig a little bit deeper than the hype which is out there, and you just look at the reality behind a lot of these people, you find they've had a story just like any of the rest of us could do as well. So it's
absolutely. And you know, this brings us into something that I'd like to hear you talk a little bit more about, explain it to everybody, this NLP, this neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah.
Something that I heard a little bit about, you know, when I was going to be trained to be a coach and everything, and NLP. And I don't really know a whole lot about it. So tell us a little bit about that.
NLP. There's a lot of people talking about NLP out there. If you type it into your browser on your computer, you are going to come up with a million and one different people. And they all have different approaches, and people have kind of interpreted it in different ways. And at its essence, it's about saying that everything is psychological. It's how you view your world. Your vision of the world is the world that you end up getting. And if you can change your vision of the world, the way you view the world, you will get different results. And I mean, I've used it throughout my life at times when I've had really tough moments. I'm trying to think of a sort of way to give people something that they could kind of do straight away. One of the things I love is goal setting, and it's in traditional goal setting, you just kind of write down what you want and then you kind of say it to yourself over and over again. But the moment you start to actually put yourself inside that goal and you start to feel what it would be like inside the goal and what it will look like, what you will see, what you can hear, what you can touch, what the air will be around you, what people will be doing, how they will be interacting with you. When you start to create, you put yourself into that goal that you want, and you really associate yourself with it, and you feel it, you live it, you walk around in it, and then you kind of, and this is all in your imagination. None of this is real. It's because I can't do this woo-woo stuff where it's like looking into crystals and things like this. It's all in your imagination. But we're driven by our imagination. So when you then kind of go forward in time and you place it into your timeline, and you go through these processes, you look back and you start to see down your timeline and see how events are shifting, and you kind of feel those events shifting, it creates this feeling inside you that something has changed. And in exactly the same way as, like, you know, you getting into music and me getting into journalism, when you start to feel that pull, you start making choices differently, and it takes you down a different path. And it's all entirely in your imagination. It's that image you create. There's another one as well, which they talk about a lot in NLP. It's about limiting decisions. And this is exactly what we're talking about. You know, we've been talking about today, about the things that get in the way of you achieving your goals. And often limiting decisions are based on something that you have experienced in the past. And we've all had negative experiences. Now, no event in itself has any inherent meaning. If you go through a tough time, if you are beaten, if you have an abusive partner, how you come out of that is, and it sounds wrong, but how you come out of it is up to you and the way you interpret that. Now, you could come out of that feeling utterly beaten, utterly downtrodden, let's say an abusive partner, and feeling that you could never meet anyone that would ever be different from that. Or you could come out of that going, I will never go through that again. I will never ever allow that to happen again. And I will look next time for a person that will give me the love that I deserve. So you can interpret that exact same event in two completely, well, millions of different ways. And the way you interpret that then will drive you forward to a totally different life. Now, we make a lot of negative choices throughout our lives, right back to when we were a toddler falling over off the chair when we were trying to learn to walk. And if we made a negative choice at the time, that could have been with us for decades. But using your imagination, you can, if you really vividly imagine it, you can kind of go back to that time. And this isn't about actually traveling back in time. This is purely in your imagination, just like you would come up with lyrics to a song. It's exactly the same thing. You kind of visualize yourself going back there, and you actually go through that event again, but rewrite the result of it. So you look at it and you go, yeah, I came out of it the first time with a negative result. I came out of it feeling like this. But what other learning could that event have given me? What else could I have decided that would have actually led me to live a different life? So you go through the event and you stand at the side of it and you imagine yourself not in it, because you can actually feel it. The way you imagine things actually changes your physiology. So if you actually put yourself inside it, you will feel, if it was a really painful experience, you will feel that pain. But if you stand at the side in your imagination, it's amazing the difference it makes in how you feel about it. And you start to rewrite that event in the way that you wish you'd handle it, the learning that you wish you got out of it. And you rewrite this, and then you go through time and you sort of think of three other situations where, if you hadn't have got that original negative learning, how you could have done three other things differently. So again, you're reinforcing this new learning, this new way of interpreting it. And you realize that your life could have been incredibly different if you just bloody learned the right thing the first time. But because you do this and you spend, I don't know, half an hour doing this, and you really immerse yourself in the vision and you really, really think about how it feels, how it sounds and all this stuff, you cannot help but it having an influence over you as you move forward through the next few days. And it just, because you've just pushed it in so deep, I don't know whether, you know, the subconscious, conscious, they talk about this stuff, but you've practiced it so much in your head that it does, it starts to influence things. You start to feel different about things. And it's an amazing feeling. One way to talk about this imagination thing, to kind of bring it away from the woo-woo, is that when the top athletes compete, when, you know, they're going to the Olympics or whatever, before they actually do a race, they rehearse it in their mind and they see themselves winning. Because by doing that, they've already won. There's no longer that fear about, am I going to win? How am I going to do it? Am I going to make it up as I go along? They've already practiced winning in their head. And again, it's purely, purely in your imagination. But by creating that expectation of victory, by knowing how you're going to win, because you've set that future event and you've looked back about how I'm going to win, how much you're going to do it. It's not a question of whether I will, it's how I'm going to. you come out with a far, far better performance, and hopefully you win it. So your imagination is immensely powerful. And that's what NLP does. It gives you a guided visualization so that you can adjust the things that you want to adjust.
You know, what's funny about this is I coach people with some of those things you've illustrated, and I use them on myself. Yeah. And this brings forth one of my little pet peeves. Something, they always have to name something so complex, like this, using your imagination, understanding that your brain doesn't really know the difference between real and imaginary. Your brain is just kind of there. And you control what your brain does and how it processes certain information. And so I've been using these things with my clients and coaching and on myself, but never thinking that that was NLP. They always got to come up with some, long, complex name for something that I'll bet you a lot of us do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know,
before I'm giving a speech, when I'm practicing speech, this is what I coach people in when I'm dealing with public speakers, you practice your speech, maybe in front of the mirror, maybe walk around your living room and move as if you're on stage. Speak out loud as if the audience is in front of you. Just get the whole event in your cellular system. Yeah. So then when you're on stage, it comes natural. You don't have to think about your words, think about your choreographing, because you've already embedded that.
But I think what NLP does is it takes those skills. And NLP is not a set of rules. It's a way of looking at how other people do it, like you, and going, if it works for Dennis, it could work for you, or it would work for you.
Yeah.
So NLP is, people often sort of go, okay, you've got to do it this way. But NLP is simply a way of kind of looking at others and then practicing it in your head until you learn the skills that you've done. So you going in front of an audience and giving an amazing presentation. If I wanted to go and do that, I would look at how you do it. I would listen to exactly what you just said about how you approach it. And then I would visualize myself doing it to try and learn the skills that you already have used and taught yourself and learned to try and recreate that same thing. So it's about sharing ideas. It's about sharing things that you've learned, things that other people have learned, and getting the best from it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the one thing that it was good for me to eventually find out, that the brain doesn't know the difference between this and that.
Yeah.
So you can feed your brain whatever you want to, and it's going to react. Yeah. The simplest way to illustrate it, of course, it would be me to give this example. You can tell, first of all, when you smell food, you start getting hungry, even if you're smelling it down the hall. It's not in front of you. It's not dinner time. But if you smell food, your brain picks that up and you start to get hungry. You start to get prepared. Your body does that. You ever smelled food and you wasn't hungry before, but now a nice smelling pork chop? Now all of a sudden you want that pork chop, even though it's not in front of you. You know it ain't dinner time. It ain't yours. You ain't going to break into your neighbor's house. But now you're hungry because your brain doesn't actually know what time it is. Just like if you think about sex, your body's going to prepare to have it, even though you know it's not there.
Yeah.
It ain't there. Yeah. No one's there. You're just a lonely bloke at night.
Yeah.
Chilling, playing your Xbox.
Yeah.
When you think about it, your body starts to get aroused because it thinks it's about to have sex because you're introducing that idea to your brain, even though you know it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So your brain doesn't actually know what's going on. You tell it.
Well, here's another one for you. It doesn't matter whether there's a snake next to your foot about to bite you that you can't see, or whether you imagine there's a snake next to your foot about to bite you, you're still going to react in the same way. So it's imagination. It's your perception. It's the way you think about it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely.
And this is what we've got to try and program ourselves to. It's like one of the things that does slightly annoy me about a lot of NLP people is they say you've got to change your whole life. Well, no, you haven't. You haven't. All you got to do is adjust those bits that are holding you back or that you don't like. If you want to be if you want to be cantankerous and you want to be sarcastic, you want to be mean to people. Hopefully not, but you want to change that bit about the fact that you had a really bad experience in your past, which is stopping you becoming, a great storyteller. Then sort that bit out. You just got to fix those bits. You can't change, or you shouldn't try and change the whole essence of who you are. You've got to still be that core of you. But if those bits you just want to try and sort out, if you want to become a great speaker, use the techniques like you're using, Dennis, You know, it's just that's what you got to fix. Don't try and be someone else or force yourself to become someone else, because you never will be anyway. It's just too much to change.
Yeah, absolutely. I always say, be the best version of yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have to be anybody else. Just be the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
So what would you say for somebody who's listening to this program and maybe have a low self-esteem? They don't know if they can make it. Someone just told them that they sing like a dead frog or something. So what would you say to them? You know, just like what would they do in that moment? What's one thing that that person can do to keep going, to keep their head held high, regardless of what someone says?
Number one, I would say is, do you want it? Forget what anyone else says at that point. Don't go and ask them whether you should have it. Do you want it? And that's it. Just listen to yourself. And if you want it, and if you listen to yourself and you go, I don't like that, improve one small thing each time and just keep going. Because if you improve one small thing each time, you will get there. You can't not. Because if you keep improving, if you keep doing what other people who've been successful do, the only thing against you is the amount of time and effort you're prepared to put into learning to get that good. You know, if you're gonna improve once, if you're gonna do one small thing and improve and do it once a month, then it might take you 100 years to get there. But if you're passionate about something, if you want to be that singer, if you want to get into that job, if you want to be that person, and you go out there and you do one small thing every single day, you're gonna get there. So listen to yourself. Listen to what you want to achieve. Decide for yourself what you want. Ignore what other people are saying about it. And if you really want it, one small thing each day. And equally, if you don't do that one small thing, you've actually got your answer as to whether you really wanted it anyway. Because if you're passionate, you're going to go and get it and do it. Just do it.
That's a great opportunity. That's a great point. An opportunity to check yourself. Do you really want what you think you want?
Yeah.
How deep is that passion? How hot is that passion really?
Yeah. Because if you don't really want it, you won't find the energy.
No, that's right.
It's like we all do things where, you know, we've all done stuff where we get immersed in it. And you might come home from your job or from school, whatever, and you couldn't concentrate all day. And you get home and you do something, whether it's a computer game, whether it's writing a story, whether it's playing in your band. And you do it for 12 hours nonstop, and you didn't even need to drink, sleep, or even go to the toilet, because you're so passionate about it, you're so driven. And that's the stuff you really care about. So listen to yourself as well. Listen to what's driving you. You know, I should have listened to myself more about the journalism stuff. I was lucky. Things just kind of came into place. I met the right people. But if I'd actually listened to myself from the start, I would have gone far more whole hog into it and just said, forget what everyone else says. That's clearly what I want to do.
What drives you? That's right. Pay attention to what drives you. Grab hold of your stick shift and figure out what drives you.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Man, this has been great, man. I definitely appreciate really you coming on the program, man. That's excellent stuff.
Not at all. I really like what you're doing, Dennis. I really like the fact that you're talking to people and you're saying, go and do this stuff. I really like that. I respect them.
Because I think it's very important for all of us to pursue our goals, to live from our soul, to live as we are spiritual beings in a human experience, and to be better men every day. Because we need that.
I think at times as well, for guys, we're almost expected to notice stuff already. You know, it's kind of a guy, you don't need support. You don't need to think about this stuff. You know, you're a guy. You should just do it. You should just know it.
Already,
yeah. And it's like, I'm sorry, but back in the real world, no one knows every answer to stuff. No one knows exactly who they are, what they want to be. And it's like, and that doesn't mean about being, you know, that doesn't mean because you don't know this, you're insecure or a failure or anything like that. It's not. It's just the start of your path to where you're actually going. So just do it.
That's the point. Yeah, you bring up a good one. Like, why do men think that we have to know everything?
Yeah.
Oh, I know this, even though you don't know. Oh, I know how to do this, even though you don't. Oh, I have the answer for things you don't have. Why do we feel compelled? Because, I mean, I fell into this trap too, especially as a younger man. Like, I'm supposed to know this stuff. If I don't know this stuff, then there's something wrong with me. Even though I was never taught, didn't have much experience with it, but I'm supposed to know it. And if I don't know it, then that somehow makes me lesser. That's absurd. But yeah, a lot of men get into this pattern, and me included, you know, especially when I was younger. And yeah, I wonder, what is that?
I don't know. It's I don't know. As wrong as you can say it is, I think it is this gender role stuff, isn't it? It's, you know, it's still like, for all the equality, for all the kind of, you know, women and men are equal now, girls still get dolls and boys still get cars and trains, but, you know, guns and this kind of thing. And it's like, well, people still assume that girls are should be treated in a different way and boys should be treated in another way. And it's like, you know, at the end of the day, we're just who we are. You can't know everything when you're learning something. You just can't. So it's like, why do we put this pressure? I don't know. Are we just more afraid of, you know, is it this alpha male feel that we have to always appear to be the leader of the pack?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. That, you know, why we as men feel like we have to know everything, like we feel compelled to be responsible for all these things and have all this knowledge. But I don't know. I guess that definitely, we'll keep talking about this stuff. It's certainly very interesting. And you know, when I look back, what I had that attitude about certain topics, I'm like, well, how stupid is that?
Yeah.
Like, it's awkward. Like, wow, that's stupid. Why would I think I know something about stuff I don't know much about? That's stupid. But
I think everyone around, I think also when you're surrounded with people that, we're all doing the same. If we're all doing the same to each other, we all feel the same pressure that, well, if they're acting like they know everything, we feel like we have to.
Yeah.
And yet they're probably as thick as we are about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That goes back into ego and competition, but
yeah.
Yeah. If we did that, this program would be another 6 hours.
I think we could talk for more than that even.
Oh, probably. So, man, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. Like, good to have you. We got to have you back, you know?
Yeah, be great to.
Absolutely, sir.
Yeah. Well, if I ever pop across to New York, I'll certainly come and see you.
No problem. Right. I'm right here, as I always say, in Womanhattan.
Womanhattan.
But, you know. And that's why I used to say in my old show, I am broadcasting from Womanhattan. Yeah.
Right. Well, in which case, that's where I will see you.
All right, man. Thanks. Here on the Core Confidence Life, we want to hear your story. We want to hear your stories of overcoming low self-esteem and self-confidence and anxiety to create the relationships and life you want. If you're interested in coming on the program and giving us your story, just contact me at Dennis@coreconfidencelife.com. That's Dennis@coreconfidencelife.com. You can also go to coreconfidencelife.com/guest to fill out the application. That's coreconfidencelife.com/guest. If you're a man with a story or somebody who works with men to overcome these obstacles of low self-esteem and lack of confidence to create relationships and success, you're certainly welcome on the program too. I'm Dennis R. Sumlin, coach and educator. And until next time, make your own yeses out of other people's noses.